Welcome back, everybody, to It's a Chat.
It's a Chat.
A geeky podcast where two best friends chat movies, video games, TV shows, whatever we want to chat about. I am one of your hosts, Paul Williams, and as always, always by my side, the Suri to my Daniel.
Yeah, I love you.
Scott Charnock, how are you doing, Scott?
I'm all right. Oh,
we're married. I didn't even realise we were married.
No, it's a custom.
Apparently.
You're stuck with me now. But that's okay. You seem to like me.
That's true. Well, you know, yes.
I don't get any say in the matter.
No, compared to all these other, people, you're very attractive.
Thanks.
Seem to scrub up well in this desert land. We're back with our current season. We did Starship Troopers last pod, and this pod, we're delving back, I guess, into some sci-fi in our Is It As Good As We Remember kind of season. That's what we're kind of dubbing it, I guess, Scott. Are you happy with that? We're kind of...
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So, because we've probably been accused of nostalgia glasses. So we're grabbing some films that we thought we haven't seen in a long time. We really loved them in our youth or back in the day. If we look back at them now as adults, as mid-40s men... are they? I don't know why I said it like that. Are they as good as we remember back then? And so this pod, we are looking at the 1994 classic question mark because we'll decide that at the end. Stargate. Yeah. And I think Scott, you reminded me that we saw this together.
This is one of our first movies that we saw together at the cinema. Yes. Yes, young Paul and young Scott met at college, bonded through Star Wars, and went to see Stargate because it was sci-fi and not at the cinema.
And again, because at the time, because Starship Troopers was later, so this you're kind of it's a bit like the whole Marvel, like the superhero thing. I think sci-fi was few and far between. I was trying to think that 1994, like what was around like sci-fi films. I mean, do you ever? From that period, I mean, I guess you had the Star Treks. There wasn't any Star Wars. Yeah, well, I can't really think of other sci-fi.
I'd have to look it up.
Yeah, I'd have to think.
I probably should have done that if I was a professional.
I was just trying to think off the top of my head.
What's Paul going to ask me? He's going to ask me what movies were.
Because I guess this was, it was. A big hit at the time, it feels like it was a hit for that year, and it obviously spawned the popular TV show. Yeah. I mean, again, I didn't, so I guess that's a good place to start. Did you watch Stargate, the TV show?
I did watch Stargate, the TV show, a lot. I did watch it a lot. And did you know what? Funny enough, I was going to say in my Stargate research that I've done. Which was basically Googling Stargate movie. I found a few articles on websites that I shall not name that seem to have been purely written by AI. And AI seems to have confused TV series with movie quite a lot. Because I think the TV series was probably more popular than the movie.
I would say so. It's because I kind of fell off it in the first season. I mean, I was very excited about it. And MacGyver himself in it. And I think my main problem was because one of my favourite characters in Stargate is Daniel, as portrayed by the amazing James Spader. And I didn't like the Daniel version in the TV show. And I kind of, he was buff, way too buff for my liking. Yeah. And I don't know why, but teenage Paul just didn't really gel with that. And I kind of, to be honest, that was probably one of my main reasons I didn't get into it, but it ran for quite a while as well and had spin-offs of its own.
Stargate Atlantis, and then one after that I didn't watch, but it did happen. So 1994 films, it was Star Trek Generations in 1994, which obviously we went to see too.
True But I guess that
Vampire, it's not really sci-fi. No. But I love Interview with, in fact, Interview with Vampire is a prime candidate for the current season.
Yeah, we should add that to list.
Ace Ventura, Pet Detective.
Oh, well, year of Jim Carrey then. That sounds like it.
Yeah, I mean, he was big there. A movie called Blown Away? Maverick. Do you remember Maverick? Mel Gibson.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one. That's a good one. Yeah, questionable Leon. Mel Gibson, but good, wow. Good one. Oh, Leon. Nice. Leon, but yeah, but like I say, for sci-fi, it I would, guess that yeah. Generations Speed. Was... Oh, wow. Well, Speed is...
Shawshank yeah. Redemption. Mm. There's even Steven Seagal movie on Deadly Ground.
So not one of the best.
Street Fighter.
Wow. Yeah.
With old Jean-Claude.
What did you Google here?
Just popular 1994 films. This
is popular. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, to be honest. Popular.
The Crow. Yeah. The Crow.
Okay.
The next Karate Kid. I could go on.
But I guess even from what you've mentioned there, I feel like Stargate does rise to the top there. It does sort of feel like from from the time
I
that
don't
we.
Know, man. I think Pulp Fiction was 1994 as well.
Oh, well, yeah. But I guess for
big, sci-fi.
For big popular film. I mean, for kind of. Because I guess this is trying to be a low budget blockbuster. You know, it wasn't a very big budget. It was a new pair of writer director, or sort of writer producers and director in the soon to become. I mean, this is before they were huge, which is Dean Devlin and Ronald Emmerich. They'd done Universal Soldier before this. So this is their second film. They're very young, sort of fresh out of film school.
Wow.
Yeah, Universal Soldier. Probably that's worth a rewatch as well.
Yeah.
But obviously
Van Damme again.
It was their next film that shot them into the stratosphere, which was obviously the little-known Independence Day. And that became their kind of signature thing then, a kind of disaster movie, big budget, possibly sci-fi sometimes kind of thing. And then they kind of, I don't know, it all went a bit pear-shaped. But I still, you know, looking back on it, like Stargate was kind of the making of them. You know, that was kind of, you could see a lot of their signature sort of stuff in this film to then go on to Independence Day. But yeah, I suppose before you rewatched Stargate, how did you feel about Stargate, the film, not the TV?
Very fond. I had very fond memories of it. It's not a movie that I've watched a ton, to be honest. Like I say, I've watched the series to death when it was airing, particularly when Dad got Sky and we were very lucky. Stargate was on a lot. Stargate SG-1, as it was called. But the movie, I definitely had it. And I've definitely watched it a fair amount, but I reckon we're maybe going back. It's got to be over a decade ago was when I last watched this movie.
Mm.
So a long time, which is odd considering the high opinion that I had of it. So
yeah.
I bet yourself, mate.
I think it's one of those ones. It's definitely in my sort of. You know, love that sci-fi genre, and it kind of falls into, like we talked about, X-Files was my thing, my jam during the 90s, so it falls into that great aliens are responsible for everything. And I think I always loved a bit of Egyptology. You know, wouldn't say that I believe aliens built the pyramids, but probably when I was a kid, you suspect, well, who else would have done it? That makes perfect sense. And it's
Egyptians couldn't have.
No way. No, slaves could have done that. It's got to be aliens. And ancient civilizations and all that kind of stuff. I was fascinated with all that stuff as a teenager and still am. And I think it's like Ronald Emmerich says himself, it's just great story fodder. Like the actual, just the idea, even if you don't believe it, that aliens built the pyramids, it's just a great setup. And like we'll get into with the film, it has an amazing setup of this idea. And so it's definitely on my rewatch playlist. I think I've watched it recently with the kids as well. I think it's a good family film as well. I think the kids really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? There's not a lot of, it's just scary enough in places to sort of give it a little bit of an edge here and there.
Yeah, but and again, nothing too scary. And Hallam's, went through a bit of an alien phase as well, like with UFOs and stuff. So I think it really... piqued his interest in that way. So no, it's weird that how highly I regarded the film and didn't really get into the TV show. And I think And I guess it feels like one of those, even though it sets itself up for almost for the TV show or for a sequel, I feel like it kind of did everything it needed to do in the film. I don't feel like I needed to know more.
I think it's interesting you say sequels, because I read a bit about the movie makers were, they had planned a trilogy. So each movie was going to take a different sort of mythology, like a Norse mythology for the next one. So it was how they were going to approach it.
Interesting.
Yeah. I think it would have been really cool. And I believe that they may even be talking about a remake, like now, like sort of modern
times. Well, and you know, Kurt Russell is still, you know, just doing that Godzilla TV show, which is supposed to be really good.
Yeah.
You know, so I feel like getting back as Jack.
That's right.
Not MacGyver. I mean, MacGyver's still around. Again, I'm forgetting his name. He's good. But yeah, if you're going to do, and then James Spader's still, you know, doing stuff, you know, and even though I don't know how highly he would go, again, watching the making ofs after I rewatched, you know, it's that standard thing that James Spader was a kind of indie darling at the time.
Yeah, he wasn't really into this script to start off with, was he?
No.
And the whole story, it wasn't until he spoke or met with a director who convinced him to do the... that and the money, I think.
Well, and I think,
he's obviously a professional, because they had to convince him to do it, and I think he's brilliant.
Oh, this is it. He did not have a bad performance at all. No. It's really good. Not even, you know, yeah, I think that he is one of the highlights of the film, and it revolves around him, and you buy it, even though he's kind of playing the kind of klutzy, sneezing nerd. It works throughout the film. He never oversteps that. Or he never overplays.
No, he's very likable. Mm. The whole movie, Daniel Jackson.
Even when he fucks them over.
Yeah, even when it turns out he can't. to get them back.
Yeah. Brilliant. But yeah, we'll jump in. We'll jump in to. We'll jump through the Stargate.
Through the giant space sphincter.
First of all, and I had to fight, it's quite hard to fight because I wanted to play a bit of it while I was writing stuff. The soundtrack to this is incredible. I love this soundtrack, but it's very hard to listen to. Again, this is kind of, we don't go into the whole streaming bullshit, but I had to listen to it through YouTube and stuff because you can't stream it. I couldn't anyway. But yeah, what's it, any thoughts on just the, because obviously we get a beautiful opening.
Yeah. So I think for me, I would say at least 40% of the awesomeness of this movie is soundtrack based. I think this movie wouldn't be the same without the soundtrack. It's absolutely brilliant. And considering they seem to have taken a bit of a punt on the sort of the composer, or
David Arnold, like
they were taking a bit of a punt on the composer at the time, he absolutely smashed it, didn't he? He did. Oh. What a great job. Yeah, and it's actually a bit iconic for me, the Stargate theme, particularly because they used it for SG-1 and all that. So, you know, I've heard it an awful lot. It's really, really good. It's like very uplifting, very exciting.
It's a very adventure. It feels very sort of 1950s adventure film kind of. Well, the whole film does, but also this soundtrack definitely gives you that Indiana Jones kind of vibe. And David Arnold doing, I mean, I know he went on to do some great soundtracks, but like I say, so was this one of his first kind of big budget ones?
Yes. Ooh. Yes, it was. Yeah.
Well, a great job. And I guess, because my main note was, why don't we get any more? They seem very reluctant to do this, to have a title sequence.
Yeah.
you don't get, for the last 10 years, probably more, they don't like to, films don't like to do this. They usually hold off the credit, you know, they even put the title, I think we've said this before, the title at the end of the film. So I don't know, what's your feelings on it? Do you get bored? Do you think, get on with it? I kind of love it. I kind of really, it settles me into a film, I feel.
Yeah, I agree with you there, mate. I do love it, yeah.
Because I find my kids always get oh, bored. Get on with it. Which is either interesting to see a younger generation and how they're kind of fed.
Have they watched The Lord of the Rings? With Galadriel spiel at the beginning.
Well, at least that's story, I guess, isn't it? That's true, trying to get, true. This is all just pure, and it's very Batman-like. I guess it reminded me of the Batman opening titles, you know, going along a very close-up of something. We don't know what it is, and it turns out to be a massive head of a pharaoh. But yeah. I always feel like this just eases me into a film, and I'm there. And like you say, the music is so incredible that it really gets you into it. So we're kind of into it, and we're introduced to our two main characters again. We get James Spader, like you say, as he does a lot of exposition, I guess, at the beginning of the film. He's kind of lectures on. I like the way that he doesn't, even though he purely. You know, he thinks it's aliens, but he won't say it to a room full of academics.
They still walk out on him, don't they?
They do.
It's very upsetting. And it's great. It's sort of, he carries on. And then you find him sort of talking to the one person, obviously the organizer or the facilitator of the lecture. And he just sort of tails off whilst talking to him.
Yeah. Is there an early lunch here? Is that what Yeah, and like you say, I think I don't think it would work if you didn't find Daniel, like you say, a likable loser. Yeah. I guess, isn't it? I mean, I guess they kind of set it up that he's been kicked. You know, the standard thing: he's been kicked out of his apartment. He's got no funding. He's a desperate man, and which is why he kind of takes up this strange offer. Actually, I am skipping a huge bit, aren't I? I've just realised. I'm skipping the great 1920s.
Yeah, the whole archaeological bit at the beginning.
Yeah, because I was going to say before we dive into the film, how did you watch this film? Was it just on Sky or was it on?
Just on. No, it was. I had this on DVD, not Blu-ray.
Mm. And was it? Is it the sort of standard cut?
Mine is the standard cut, yeah. Okay. I must have bought this, I don't know. Well, I guess when the DVD came out, when it was released on DVD.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those films that has a director's cut, which is worse than the film. They add a few bits. Even into this opening scene, this opening sequence, there's a really weird bit they add to the... Well, I can kind of talk about it when we get there. But it ruins some of the suspense and some of the kind of... just the pacing of the film itself. I think they even throw in a bit of a flashback to the alien actually arriving on Earth here, you know, in this sort of opening sequence, which is unnecessary and all that sort of stuff. Because, it's a great opening of them finding, first of all, the cover stones in the 20s and then the Stargate itself. And I think for the budget, this looks... I mean, I don't know what you feel, Scott, but it looks very big budget to me, like a lot of extras, the whole when they're putting it up with the ropes.
Another interesting factoid, a lot of extras used in the movie were, in fact, dummies. So they've done an amazing job to keep costs down.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. It's one of the factoids I've read about.
I guess that's especially for later on when they got the just masses of miners.
Yeah,
that would work because
I didn't know. I mean, if that is true, I didn't notice that at all. They do a great job.
Yeah. I guess just to fill out the ranks would make perfect sense because it feels quite like a David Lean kind of epic, in the desert, Lawrence of Arabia kind of feel to it for the budget it's got.
55 million was its budget originally.
Wow. See, I mean, I think that just shows the kind of inflated. I mean, obviously that's in the 90s, but still, I think there's a lot of talk at the moment about overinflated sort of budgets of these massive films. But because this one, I think it's almost a perfect size for a blockbuster. And it doesn't feel like all the money's on screen. It feels like as an example of this. And we get to meet, I guess, the person who initiates all this. I'll get her name. What's her name? The old lady.
Let's have a little look.
I'm just
Catherine
Langford. So we see her as a little girl and she steals something. Jesus. Steals a little amulet with the Eye of Ra. Because I guess this is a very kind of... I mean, have you got any feelings about, you know, like the Carter and the plundering of Egypt by West?
Well, it's not just Egypt, is it? Like Europe, European superpowers, not just Britain, but France.
Yeah, we all did.
And Spain and the Dutch. And there's one stomp in Germany, of course. They have done this forever. Doesn't make it right, but
that's
something that all our countries are guilty of in the past.
Mm. Yeah, and I guess it's not. Yeah, this film isn't about that. It's about.
It isn't. I know what you mean. I guess. I mean, you take it at face value, don't you? I mean, she was a child at the time. So.
Yeah, and I think it's more her father is the kind of archaeologist and the guy. Yeah. I mean, again, it seems very, it's portrayed in a very Indiana Jones feel kind of way, working with the locals to kind of uncover this, and it doesn't feel, you know, like they're plundering some dark tomb. It all seems very legit.
Yeah.
But yeah, we discover our Stargate, and then we flash forward. So then we flash forward to meeting Daniel in present day. I always love that present day.
Yeah.
No sooner do you age a film when you say present day. Present day, present day, early 90s. Otherwise, she'd be very old by now. Jeez. But I think, like I say, Joan Spader is the linchpin of the film. And yeah, just incredible performance, I think.
He does a great job. Daniel is very likable, and I love every moment he's on screen, which is unusual, I suppose, because I'm quite a, like I've said before, one of my guilty pleasures is Fast and Furious and stuff like that, and I like a good action movie, I like a good action hero and stuff like that. Daniel is not an action hero, is he? Yet he kind of carries this movie. So
well, I get, and because I guess you've got to side him with an action hero, you've got to pair him.
Do.
With, and we get to meet him next. I always not forget about the next scene because it, and I don't know what you feel
it's
about
hard,
this.
It's hard, isn't it?
It's hard. And I guess, especially, this is why we're doing it, especially now. So now we're parents.
Yeah.
And so the next scene is the kind of, it's very depressing. We're going to go get our, Kurt Russell is our Colonel Jack O'Neill. He's an all American soldier, but we obviously meet him at the low ebb of his life. Because he is mourning the passing or the accidental death of his son, who was shot using,
using Kurt Russell's character, Jack O'Neill's own sidearm. Yeah, heavy.
Very heavy. You have a very interesting way of introducing, because I guess...
Because he's going to kill himself in this scene. He's picking up the gun to shoot himself before the military come in. Hefty. And I just to expand on that a little bit, I really believe that Kurt Russell and portraying Jack O'Neill is a little bit dead inside and has a bit of a death wish, has no interest in living. He does it incredibly well. Hat off to him. It's what a job.
Yeah, and I think it's an interesting, again, you're kind of introduced to your two leads, and they both have these massive flaws. You kind of have James Spader, who is just ignored by, you know, his peers and ridiculed by his peers, and then you meet our action hero lead, and immediately you're setting him up with this massive, he's about to commit suicide. Like you say, he's depressed. They've basically reinstated him or reactivated his commission because they know that they're going to need somebody to go through and, like you say, Scott, kill themselves as well. Like, oh, if you've got a death wish, fine. I feel like that's the, because that's what, does that feel like that to you as well? The main reason they've got him back is purely because they know his mental state, or do you think they've,
they're playing on that. They have selected someone that they know. will complete the mission that they want to happen, and that they're going to ease their consciences by selecting someone that they know who doesn't necessarily has no more interest in life, which is horrific.
Yeah, yeah.
We didn't think we were going to come on the pod and depress ourselves.
like we've said, he has this long kind of, you know, like he's been out of commission for a while, so he's got his long haircut. And then when we next see him, he does have the most, like we like to say on this pod, the most incredible crew cut I've ever seen. How does his hair just stay so straight, Scott?
There's some proper product in there, isn't there? That is,
it's like a doll. Powerful. It's like a doll.
It is. That's powerful hair.
That is powerful. but like you say, I think it works because they are such strong opposites, I guess, doesn't it? Mm. I mean, I think the film kind of hinges on these two characters, and it's not like it's a buddy film, is it? Really?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah,
I don't think so. I mean, you could potentially see them, maybe, unlikely as it is, two contrasting personalities perhaps forming a friendship after the movie. But and indeed during Stargate SG-1, I mean, Jack O'Neill was a very different Kettler Fish in that series, played by MacGyver, because though he's got an edge to him, he's very funny, he's sort of comedic and stuff like that. He doesn't carry any of this sort of baggage that this Jack O'Neill does or seems to. So yeah, it's not a buddy movie though, mate, is it?
No, it is. It's kind of, I guess, like a fish out of water story. Yeah. If you're gonna really give it a title like that. But yeah, so yeah, Daniel is recruited by this top secret strange mission, gets to go into this underground, always underground, isn't it? Always has to be an ex missile silo. There must be loads of these empty missile silos all over America. And we're introduced to some more researchers, which I recognized Richard Kind as Gary Myers. I know because I watched a lot of Spin City in the 90s as well, but he does a great, again, it does, the researchers do a great turn of being the academics in this kind of military institution. Any thoughts on our introduction to this world of a underground military base and our science?
It's brilliant. I think I messaged you. I watched the movie in chunks, before I went to work and stuff like that. And the first half an hour, I think, is nearly perfect in terms of how it sets up the story and introduces you to the idea of the movie, it being aliens invented Egypt, wherever. But also that the sort of the archaeology behind it and the Air Force, how the Air Force are involved, and sort of the team of, they're not a team of civilians, I guess, but they're Catherine's team, who are working with the military, in inverted commas, to sort this out. And I love the way that Daniel comes in and he's just, you know, he's crossing out translations and going, well, this is wrong, it's this. And so you get to see he's being ridiculed by his contemporaries about his ideas, but he's clearly a very, very clever young man. So it's, I think that sort of first 30 minutes is nearly perfect.
Yeah. And I think, like we're saying about Daniel, like, even though he's, yeah, like you say, he's crossing out, oh, this is all wrong. Why, who translated this? What?
Yeah.
It still comes across as somehow likable. Like, he's not like even though he's got arrogance and he's got, I am the smartest man in the room kind of vibe to him in a Sherlock Holmesy kind of way, but it still has that, you know, he doesn't do it maliciously or he doesn't do it to get one over on anybody. He's just doing it because it's like, well, I'm helping you, I've got to. And I like the way it does, like you say, it sets up everything, it teases out everything. You're not told it's aliens, you kind of suspect it's aliens. You kind of know it's aliens, but they kind of really, they do a good job of really, you know, what the shapes are in the middle of the Katush, the stone thing. like, it's, you know, there's they're not hieroglyphs and they don't know what it is, and it's very obvious once they figure out, you know, he even says, oh, it's, this is translated as Stargate, you think, oh, it's constellations. And then in, and like they say themselves, in 2 weeks he's figured out what they couldn't do in over 2 years. So, but there must be, but it feels like there must have been momentum, the fact that they've got Kurt Russell's character there, you know, and like he says, like he's trying to take over from Catherine, and Catherine thought she had complete autonomy in this place, but he says, I'm here in case you succeed. So it feels like they've got an inkling of what's going on anyway, which makes you suspect, like I say, if you want to think of a wider world outside of Stargate, whether there are, you know, they're already aware of aliens and already aware of some of this. It feels like, I don't know what you feel, Scott. It doesn't, again, for the movie, I guess they just wanted to get in there just to, because like you say, we haven't got time for...
No, we don't.
we're yickety split. Because it feels like once he figures out it's constellations, we're then into that meeting scene, which is cool as well. And again, he comes across as a bumbling idiot mixed with the most smartest man in the room. And I like the way he treats the military. I think one of my notes is, you know, that he doesn't make enough photocopies.
No.
He's asking all these very high power generals to share. But yeah, that geek energy that he has is quite infectious, and it's just all exposition, you know, even explaining how you need 7 points to plot a course and all this stuff that's obviously going to be very important later on is the mechanic of the, I guess that is the main mechanic of the film, I guess, isn't it? Like the driving force is you need these 6 symbols in order to activate
and the point of origin.
Yeah. Yeah, you've got the 7th symbol as your point of origin, and he's figured out, you know, they couldn't figure out where this 7th symbol is, and it's actually right at the bottom of, and
it's right here.
Yeah, and immediately they have to unseal it all, I guess, because it's all very, very secretive, and James Spade, Daniel, is working with blinders on because he doesn't know actually what he's doing. And then they reveal, it's a Stargate. Here it is. It's just behind this very convenient sliding wall. Is the Stargate itself? And then they turn it on. This is, like you say, Scott, is this like half an hour in? Like they actually switch on?
Yeah. It's pretty much half an hour on the dot. 20 minutes to half an hour. This whole sort of turning the Stargate on. Like you say, once they get Daniel in, and once he kind of cracks. The puzzle and gives them the clue, they're basically going through, aren't they? And I don't know if, I mean, obviously for the purposes of the movie, it's brilliant because it moves on with stuff we want it to move on with, but would that really happen? I don't know.
They send through like a little probe, the probe goes through, it sends back some pictures, they realise the symbols on the other side aren't the same. Therefore, they've got to call off the mission. They were going to go through to kind of check stuff. And then Daniel rather arrogantly says, I can get us back. Of course I can. Look what I did in 2 weeks.
He's certain of it.
he says himself, I mean, would you be, if you were Daniel, Scott, would you be that sure?
100%.
And obviously, I mean, why would, I mean, I guess this is like, this is proving everything you've ever believed. I mean, why wouldn't you go through? I mean,
yeah, that's right. If you're Daniel, there's only one thing you're gonna do, isn't there? You're absolutely right. And he's reacting very selfishly here.
Yeah,
but I mean, he is very, very clever. He has no reason to think that that he couldn't get through. There is a massive level of assumption there, though, isn't there? he doesn't even clarify his statement, like, if this is there, I'm certain I could get us back.
He just says, I can
get us back.
Yeah, get back. Yeah. Fine, it's fine. And so they assemble their team of soldiers. This is kind of, I guess this is our, you know, I watched Aliens again recently. You know, you've got your crack squad. And I guess only Aliens, as I still feel, have done a really good job of giving you a believable kind of Marines, and also you get each of, again, I literally watched Aliens a week or so ago, that you introduce them and you get each of their characters from just looking at them.
Yeah.
I mean, Cameron is very incredible at doing that. I can't say I get the same from this group of soldiers.
If there's a weak point to the movie, I guess it's the soldiers. It's the soldier squad. But they're such a part B of it, really, aren't they? They're just there because kind of, the military would probably send numbers.
Yeah, and I guess
to die.
Yeah, because they are. They're purely that. They're kind of cannon fodder. I lose track of who gets murdered and who kind of gets injured as well. There's quite a few people who think, well, you got shot and you're still here, but he got kicked and he's dead. Yeah. It's very difficult to keep track of these poor sods who kind of makes it out. And the ones were kind of, again, you're listening to this, only three of them make it back. Two of the soldiers make it back.
Yeah.
I can't even remember how many we start with. And I think I even texted you, Scott, that one of the soldiers that makes it back, one of the soldiers that we kind of focus on, is the great actor, French Stewart, who I know from Third Rock from the Sun. I mean, did you watch Third Rock from the Sun much, Scott?
Inspector Gadget 2,
exactly, no, but the first one. He's a great comedic actor, quite a thin, I almost think he looks a bit like me.
I don't buy him as a soldier.
No.
It's such a weird choice. What do you think? Did you think they thought they needed some star power for the Marines?
I don't know, because I don't know how big a star. I don't think he was even big then. I think Third Rock, I'd have to look it up, but I think Third Rock was kind of starting in the 90s. But it's not like French Stewart was, oh yeah, he's a name and he will have to get him in. And he's not even that funny. He's an arsehole in the film.
I mean, Daniel just does basically strand them on an alien world. So you can understand them being a bit knocked off, but he's a bit of a bully, isn't he?
It's a legitimate, because I guess it's him and the other guy who I can't even name, the kind of balding one who also survives. He's kind of nice to Daniel until he strands them. And like you say, and the rest are generic soldiers, which is a shame. I'm not saying it's just purely, we don't have time to get to know them. They are just soldiers.
So I should point out, though, we're calling them soldiers. I guess they're soldiers, but this is the US Air Force.
Sorry.
So they're airmen.
Airmen. Okay.
Yeah.
So these airmen, and Daniel. And next, I guess we get this is the sequence that's probably best known, I guess one of the... the highlights of the film as well. They turn the Stargate on and they all slowly march up this ramp and through the Stargate, and Kurt Russell gives good face, like you were saying.
He does. Man, those eyes. He's gorgeous. Kurt Russell eyes. They're sort of, I don't know, they're glinting with the ghosts of his past.
And he also does this great, he clenches his teeth. You know, he clenches his jaw, he sets his jaw before he kind of steps through the Stargate. Because none of them know what Kurt the fuck Russell. Is going to... They seem very... They're not even in, like, I don't know, hazmat suits or...
No, they aren't. I mean, they've taken readings from the probe that went through. One of the comments that you hear is, it's breathable, or the atmosphere is comparable to Earth. So, but you're absolutely right. I mean, you're gonna go through to an alien world here, and they just march through in fatigues, don't they?
yeah, they got their guns out front, but they're very much, they don't know what the hell, they seem to be, they know they're going to dematerialize. I guess they've got that great little computer, as always, you love a good film computer graphic that's telling you exactly what's happening.
Yeah.
Dematerializing.
Just before we get to this, what do you think about the whole? I thought the Stargate turning on was awesome. The chevrons locking in places, and that first moment where the sort of it kind of seems to inhale and then spill out a load of sort of that liquid before it sucks it back in again. It's very cool.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, that whole, you know, like they say, they've always got to, like, they knew the six symbols. They put the six symbols in.
Yeah.
The bass starts shaking. This is as far as we've always got.
Mm.
And then they put the last symbol in. And yeah, like you say, just that silence and then that. Yeah, the effect itself, like water. Very, yeah. Sort of
it's
watery.
Still held up.
It does. I mean, it's, yeah, it's obviously CG, but yeah. But no, I think that whole water technology around the time of the Abyss and all that, I think CGI getting to grips with water. So no, yeah, really good. Yeah. No, I love it, Scott. Yeah. I think this sequence of them all walking through, and like they say, with Daniel kind of gets there, and apparently that was improvised, where he just stands there and puts his hands out and is kind of feeling the Stargate, and it's all rippling out from his hands.
The magic of James Spader.
James Spader apparently just, improvised that on the day. So that's a cool. And then, him just closing his eyes and that great. And I love that sound, that just the sound gets sucked out and you just have that gloopy, that sort of watery sound effect of his face going through before it dematerializes, I guess. And we get sucked through.
Yeah.
The Stargate.
More CGI. Sucked through more CGI.
And then we're on the other side of the galaxy, on another planet. So I'm just catching up with my notes. Yeah.
Yeah, that's insane too, isn't it? I thought that was brilliant. That scene where he's kind of looking at the map and saying, "Where is it? Where is it?" And they point to it over here. And they say it's on the other side of the galaxy. And when you try and put into context how that, like, the distances involved in that, it kind of highlights what a big deal this is. It's would be, I mean, utterly civilization changing.
And I think they sort of stumble out of this pyramid, I guess. They sort of, it looks exactly like the pyramids on Earth, and then there's three moons, I think, above the pyramid. As they sort of stumble out onto the desert, and I think a lot of this was shot in Arizona, I want to say. The Arizona desert. Again, America is just too goddamn big, because it looks majestic. it does look like Egypt, or it looks like a sort of a distant Tatooine kind of a planet. But when do you think, and I guess when was the moment Daniel realized they were fucked?
That's a good point. I mean, I mean, it's almost right away, isn't it? Essentially, it's right away. This one's broken off at the bottom here. He hasn't found that yet. Sorry, there's no stone at all, is there? There's no sign of any symbols at
because
this point,
he sets it up in his opening speech, because he says that inside the pyramid there's no markings. Which is why he thinks that it proves that there is a more ancient civilization that created the pyramid. So when they reach this planet, it's an exact replica of the pyramid he was talking about. So there are which has no symbols, no hieroglyphs. They have to find life, or in this desert planet that looks like there's nobody there at that time. And he has nothing. Yeah. And like he says to them, they're all just like ready to go back. Yeah, they've done a little bit of research. And it feels like, I guess, so this is the only bit I'm slightly confused about. So Kurt Russell, so Jack is there to blow up the Stargate on the other side if he finds danger or
that's
possible,
right.
but so was he going to do it anyway, because he's getting it all ready?
I think it's a little bit ambiguous. I think quite possibly he's just going to set this thing off
no matter what he finds.
I think even back on Earth, I think they've already pretty much decided that it's too dangerous. This is too dangerous. They're going to go through, and Kurt Russell's going to set this bomb off. But the team are already going to have come back almost regardless of what they find there. So, yeah.
Yeah, it feels like that, doesn't it? Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. And that's what they're all setting up to do and all ready to go back until Daniel reveals. I love it when he said, we just need to just have a look around.
Yeah, there must be a tablet or something.
A phone number. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so the airmen all get very very annoyed with him, don't they?
But they're so ill prepared. Why haven't they got more rations? Why haven't they got more?
Because they basically were just gonna go back straight back through. They're just gonna go there, have a look, fine, we've gone through, we're gonna go straight back. That seemed to have been the thing. So that's they were completely, you're absolutely right, they were woefully prepared for an extended stay on this alien planet that is on the other side of the galaxy. I mean, when you think about it, that's a frightening prospect, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you were, I guess, if you were Daniel or you were an airman in this base, would you be one? Would you go through, Scott?
Do you know, I probably would. I probably would. It's very, I mean, could you resist? Could you resist, I guess, going through?
Yeah.
If you were given the opportunity.
Mm.
And you've got this guy who says he can guarantee getting you back.
And he's likable. He's so nice.
He's so likable. Yeah. He sneezes a lot. He's clearly a nerd. But then we need a nerd to get us back. So I believe him. And he solved that thing in 2 weeks.
That's true. It's true.
And then for Daniel, there's no choice at all, is there? He's always going to go through.
Oh, yeah, he does. I mean, again, as happens at the end of the film, I mean, even if he doesn't make it back, who cares? What's he going back to? I think similar. Yeah. Maybe that's the similarity between he's got nothing to kind of...
Yeah.
I don't want to say live for. That's the wrong thing. But he's not got any sort of personal connections back on Earth. But he's going to find them here on this... Do we ever get a name for this planet? I don't think we do. This other... Earth B.
Abydos.
Abydos. Did we get this in that film? Or is this later in... Is this part of the TV show? Or is that...
No. I think it's just Abydos. Yeah.
Abydos. So sorry to interrupt the pod here, but we have an exciting thing, Scott. We're going to have to do a little bit of an advert.
This is wow. Exciting.
I know. This is how big we've become. It's for something that we've used since the inception of It's Chat. And I think without this, we would not be able to do what we've been doing.
No, it served us very well. Very, very, very pleased to promote the product for sure.
Yeah. So we're talking of Zencastr, which is the online app that we've been using since episode one. Of It's a Chat, and still use it today. And I don't think I am right in saying, Scott, I don't think it's ever let us down.
No, it's never let us down.
In fact, it's saved our asses, I think.
Saved our asses when our backups...
our backups are broken, or if the internet goes down.
Yeah.
I think that the first time that happened, I thought, shit, that's it, it's gone. But it's saved, and then we could carry on recording. I mean, I don't even know how it does that, because you just assume...
That was a bit of a miracle, because, you know, I mean, when you think about sort of the effort you put into sort of chatting, researching, and then chatting about a thing, and particularly where we're unscripted, just it would never be the same chatting about the same thing again, would it?
I feel so lucky that we haven't yet, touch wood, had to do that. And I think that is because we use Zencastr, and because the quality of the kind of audio that we get off of this as well. There's no lag. You know, I edit the pod, and I've used almost all the time the files that Zencastr give us. Just an incredible service that we use. So we're proud to be able to basically promote them through our pod, because without them, It's a Chat wouldn't be possible. The great thing is that if you go to zencastr.com/pricing and use the code It's a Chat, that's our title of our podcast, It's a Chat, you'll get 30% off your first month of any Zencastr pay plan. So they do have pay plans, and you can get 30% off now using It's a Chat as the code offer.
That's brilliant. I'm quite disappointed you didn't say that, like Admiral Akbar.
Though. Oh, that's true. I couldn't say the whole thing. And it does work. Okay. No. And I've got another line. I can try. I want you to have the same easy experiences I do for all my podcasting and content needs. It's time to share your story. It's a Chat.
Yes, well done.
So Abydos, the planet Abydos. And luckily for Daniel, who's a bit screwed, He finds a, I don't want to call it. What is it? It's not really a horse. I know, like it is a
pack
horse.
Animal of some yeah, description.
It is a horse that they stuck a massive puppet on. But yeah, he's very lucky to have found that in the middle of this desert.
It goes off. After being picked on by the soldiers, doesn't he? He wanders off, and then there's a sort of a chase, quite a funny chase across the desert. He's being dragged across the desert by this thing. And once again, three soldiers, or three airmen. I'm going to say soldiers. They're just soldiers. Chase them across the desert. Once again, like, I can only presume they've worn a lot of sun cream, Paul, because I tell you what, I'd be sunburnt as hell.
Very, very true. They sweat a lot. I will give them that.
Yeah, true. I mean, it's hot there.
But you're right. They don't. I think he's even looking for sun cream when he's going through all his pockets and he's finding foot powder and all this sort of stuff in his multiple fatigues pockets, but not sun cream. So yeah, you're right. They would be red as hell.
They would be red as hell.
But instead of that, they find what they're looking for. They find civilization, I guess.
Yes.
But ancient civilization, I guess. Arrested Development? Is that the right way of putting it?
Yeah, well, these are, I think, Egyptians that were moved through the gate to this planet to basically be slaves. So we don't really know that yet.
No.
They're clearly mining something, but we don't know why or who or what for.
No, and I think this is where your dummies come into good use, because it looks like there are thousands of people mining this cliff face.
It really does, doesn't it?
And it just looks, I think again, for a low budget, but a $55 million film.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. You really get a sense of this scale. There's these massive tents that are all kind of, I guess, cleaning the mineral. And it's the mineral from, as one of the airmen, soldiers. again, with a doohickey that seems to not exist in the world, you know, manages to, it can scan material elements. Of course it can. It's made from the same material as the Stargate. So this planet is rich in whatever mysterious alloy the Stargate is made from, which, as we find out, is what this alien creature's entire technology, I guess, is based on.
Naquada or something like that. I remember it being.
As long as it's not unattainable. Unattainable?
Unobtainium.
Oh. Unobtainium, bloody hell. Yeah, as long as it's not that, Scott, I don't
know. Elementium.
I love the fact that they had this poor Egyptologist researcher guy who did create a dialect for ancient Egyptian, which had never been spoken or never been heard. So they had to make up this language, and apparently it is a bit like Klingon and all that. It does actually kind of work.
Wow.
The main actor, the main head of the tribe, let's say, he would learn his lines just before, because apparently there wasn't a lot of script for his character. And the actor himself said that he would just make up lines.
Eric Avery as Kasuf, the local leader.
And he would go to the Egyptologist to kind of say, well, I want to say this. How would I say this in ancient Egyptian? And he would then translate it, tell him phonetically, and then he would go off. He did a really good, I just watched some making of, and like he himself said, it's not just about the words, it's about the kind of intonation. And you want to put, because it does a great job of, like, you kind of understand what he's saying, even though you don't, you know, this is an ancient language that nobody actually understands. What's your thoughts on these? I don't want to say primitive people, because they're not really, but these, I guess, ancient Egypt.
Once again, they're very likable, aren't they? they're just very likable. You kind of you root for them, or I root for them as the movie goes on.
Yeah,
they're a very unfortunate situation, and trying to make the best of that situation. But they're clearly very close knit, and and look out for each other and everything. So it's, you know, they're a very likable people.
Yeah, and as we find out later, they kind of, writing's been banned, and they're very much, I guess, a religious cult in a way, because they follow Ra as a god. They believe he is a god.
Yeah.
And surrounded by godlike creatures, and they don't know the truth. So they are basically working for what they consider a god, in the name of Ra. And they think that Daniel, because he, I mean, I guess it is a bit of a, just because he wears the necklace with the eye of Ra, they believe he is an, I guess, an emissary of Ra himself. I don't know, doing an inspection, checking on the mining, seeing how it's all going. And they obviously, like I say, there's a big set, well, they kind of lead them back to their city again, which is a nice, impressive little miniature set. And is hit by a massive sandstorm, and they have to close the gates. And as we learn later, the sandstorm isn't really a sandstorm. I guess it's a wet, it's a the landing of the massive spaceship.
That's right.
I think it's kind of heralding that. Because obviously, yeah, they've activated the Stargate, which has alerted our alien friend. And I guess we are, well, we'll get into that, I guess. We'll get into introducing Ra himself, but I guess we can, well, I guess as part of, sorry, getting ahead of myself, as part of the tribe, we've got the tribe leader, like you said, Scott, and two other important characters, in the name of Suri, am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, I think so.
Shuri,
yeah,
which
yeah.
is the the, I don't know what you call him, not a chief. I don't know. That's
yeah, wrong. He's a chieftain. Tribe's chieftain. Yeah.
Yeah, his daughter. And then I guess we never find out. Is it his son as well? I'm guessing. Kind of feels like it is.
Yeah, that's right. Kurt Kusov's teenage son, Skara.
Skara.
Or Skara. Don't know. S-K-A-A-R-A. Skara.
Skara. Two
and
very
mates.
And his lots of, and his little friends,
and his band
and mates. Yeah, like you say, I mean, they're just very, yeah. What's your thoughts on the, yeah? Because they're just, like you say, they're just incredibly welcoming.
They are, yeah. They're very likable, even for teenagers. You know, they do such a good job of making you root for the right individuals in this movie. It's great. It's not all roses, though, because Kasif does just present his daughter as a bride to Daniel Jackson. So, you know.
But again, yeah, so. I don't know. Well, again, I guess because it is that they think Daniel is a, like you say, an emissary from their god.
Yeah.
And I guess to them, that is an offering, I guess.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're talking about a people who have never evolved past Egypt, ancient Egypt, so thousands of years ago, and still hold to the same values, I guess, as they did back then. So it's not all going to be roses, is it?
Yeah. But I mean, I think that's all coming up, because I say the big sandstorm, they left French Stewart in charge for some reason. As this massive spaceship, which is shaped like a pyramid. Again, incredible design. Love it. Always knew it was true, Scott. I knew it was aliens.
The something I wanted to say is the look of Ra and his followers, you know, his soldiers, and his, it's so cool. It's like the perfect fusion of ancient Egyptian sort of style and look with sci-fi. It's wicked. I love it.
Yeah, yeah. Just that idea. I mean, again, we find out that they're just sort of retractable helmets in the cases of the other gods, but you kind of love how Horus and all the, you know, whether it's the dog faces or the birds, and it's just these cool, just really tall masks, really, that retract back and reveal that there are just humans underneath. But you're right, Scott, they just, that I love the aesthetic of it. It just really pays homage to that civilization with that sci-fi spin.
Yeah. I love the weapons and everything as well, because they're obviously brutally effective. They're not just weapons of efficiency. They're designed to scare and intimidate, you know, along with those, as you say, those sort of godlike helmets that they wear on top of their heads that sort of dress, that make them look like 8 foot tall. I mean, they're all hench, aren't they? 8 foot tall demigods or gods, basically, in the service to Ra.
Ra surrounds himself with either hench men or children.
Yes. Yeah. What do you think about Ra and the actor that plays Ra?
Let's talk about it now. Yeah, because so Jay Davison plays Ra, it's an interesting, because this is basically Jay Davison's second role after winning an Academy Award for The Crying Game.
Yeah.
An incredible performance in that. And then after playing this role, which apparently only took because he requested $1 million, they gave it to him, and so he felt like he had to do it. And then he retired from acting after this. But I know he struggled a lot, and watching the making of, like, he struggled a lot with the language, you know, being a made-up kind of thing, and they had to cue card him in the end. But I think he works really well, because it's such an unexpected kind of look to, you know, this is our villain. All right, there's an alien inside him. We kind of see that alien a couple of times. But really, I think he portrays that kind of arrogant, youthful
otherworldliness as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Does a really great job, but I agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel a bit awkward at times, and maybe, you know, not as, it doesn't feel as comfortable in the role. You can sense that sometimes. Yeah. But I don't know. I'd never really picked up on any of that until reading about it afterwards.
Yeah,
I think at the time, you know, all right, they add some glowing eyes every so often to make him maybe feel a bit more menacing. But I think, even the way he moves, it's quite smooth and almost sort of snake-like. I don't know, there's something about his movement. He kind of glides around in his quite incredible costumes that he has on. But yeah, I think he does a great job. I was kind of, it's a shame that he, you know, again, retired from acting after this, and I don't know the full reasons, haven't really looked into why or where, but I think people do look at the performance sometimes and are critical of it, but I think it works really well.
I agree.
And I like the way, and again, they tease this out, so we don't really see him yet. We kind of get French Stewart gets dragged through, and we kind of see glimpses of it as he's slipping in and out of consciousness, because they've kind of been ambushed by these godlike henchmen. We kind of hear him rather than, and because, like you say, that's the only, I mean, what do you feel about his massive helmet thing? Kind of, it absorbs into his head, I guess.
Yeah. Does it absorb right into his head? It looks like it sort of cascades down to sort of around his shoulders and stuff like that. I kind of presumed.
Rewatching it, it kind of does. There's bits of it that kind of seem to go into this. Again, he's an alien, so it doesn't. I think everybody else's ones kind of, yeah, you're right, it kind of goes down around their necks. But I think his one seems to almost absorb into his face, which is, I mean, again, he's an alien, so he could do what he wants. I'm a bit unsure of the rules.
I'm not sure there are any rules, isn't it?
Yeah. No. And then back, like I say, back at the city, Daniel is whisked away from after he eats the chicken. Oh, he does the chicken thing.
That's right.
Would you eat that lizard thing?
Absolutely. I'd get in there.
It looks like the most chickeny bit of chicken he takes out of it as well. It could have
in
maybe
for a penny, in for a pound.
I feel like they could have done a bit more with the meat he eats. It does look like a piece of chicken. Maybe give it a bit more. I don't know. A bit more.
Once again, though, that this just highlights the difference between Daniel and the rest of them. Whereas, basically, throughout the entire movie, you've got anyone who's with Daniel is going, whoa, or, oh, I don't know about trying that. Daniel Jackson is going, I'm doing that, or I'm going through this, I'm trying that, I'm having, you know. So it's again, he's very likable.
Yeah. Yeah, he's always like I say, in for a penny, in for a pound. He's definitely like I say, they might take offence if they don't accept it.
Yes,
but he's obviously going to take offence in the ultimate offence in turning down Tsuri.
Yeah,
offers herself to him. I guess. Mm. I mean, I guess again, we're looking at this now in the 2024.
Yeah.
You know, how is this aged, God? This relationship,
like I say, you could make this movie even now. You could make this movie even now, and I'm not going to say justify it away, but basically, you're saying ancient civilizations did this. This is a civilization who has never evolved past that. Basically, it's accepted in this culture. It doesn't make it right by modern standards. It's obviously wrong. And Daniel does the right thing, of course. But, you know, so even if you made this movie now, it's still a point. It's still a very relevant. It still bloody happens in the world today. So it's still a point that needs to be made and highlighted in movies and stuff. Maybe it's kind of, I don't know, maybe there would be more horror at it these days.
No, but you're right, and I think the way they handle it in the film, like you say, Daniel's not rejection, but Daniel's kind of awkwardness around it, and then realizing as he opens the door that I don't know why the chief is, what was he going to stand on the bridge the whole time listening to his daughter?
Don't
strange.
Bed is a rocking. Don't come a knocking.
But he realizes pretty quickly what it would mean. Again, like you say, he's very aware of ancient cultures and how that would work. Yeah. His rejection of her would be deemed probably a lot worse than his kind of pretending.
Potentially worse for her as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think, even though, again, we're on fast forward through this whole film and their relationship. Their relationship evolves incredibly quickly, but I like the beats of their relationship, that they meet on an intellectual level, you know, that she shows him the symbols that they find underneath the city, I'm guessing, are the hieroglyphs he was looking for. And through the hieroglyphs, he learns their language that he learns. And apparently this is a true thing about, again, from the makings of, I was listening to, that it's all about the verbs, apparently. It's all about, because a lot of people contest even now, how to translate some of the hieroglyphs or how they should be pronounced. And it's all about the verbiage. And that's what he figures when she's showing him the hieroglyphs, and they kind of sound similar to the words he knows. And he slowly learns how to communicate, how to speak their language, which again, I don't know. I really like how that relationship evolves over the film.
Yes.
To her becoming, I don't know, like a rebel leader.
Yeah.
by the end. And that's where, like I say, that's where Daniel finally finds what he was looking for. The six symbols. But that seventh symbol, that pesky seventh symbol.
Still I don't know. Can't take him home.
I don't quite know how it would have worn off like that. But anyway.
I think someone broke it off. I think it's been broken off.
It does feel, that makes more sense, I guess, because it kind of falls in the sand and it's gone all smooth. But it makes more sense. They don't want people going back through, even back then when they were shut the Stargates down. It would make sense to destroy that. But so they've almost got everything they need to get back, but it's time to leave. Daddy Jack breaks up the party. Because they've lost communication. I guess they've lost communication with their...
They have. Some of their soldiers have died in a firefight against Ra's soldiers.
Henchmen. In every sense of the word, they are hench.
They are.
And so they make their way back to discover a massive spaceship, pyramid spaceship, where the pyramid used to be. I do like that as well. I do like, I forgot that when, so is the pyramids basically a massive parking space?
It looks like it, doesn't it?
I love it.
Yeah.
And again, they don't have any sort of, they're very shit, aren't they? They just run in. They have no plan. And again, is this, I mean, is this a difference, Scott? Are you saying this is a difference between, I don't want to offend any airmen versus soldiers.
No,
you saying,
airmen, no. It's, there's no. I mean, remember that the flipping, in Britain, the SAS are a part of the Air Force.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, these are very highly trained individuals, or they should be very highly trained individuals, and they just are just running. Even Kurt Russell's character is just running around with his machine gun out at the front of everything all the time.
But he's got a death wish, though, Scott. We know that.
It's true. So he does have a death wish, but he wants to get his men home.
That's true.
Doesn't he?
That's true.
To start off with, he's not, I don't think he's on board with setting this thing off, or wasn't on board with setting this thing off with anyone else here, but other than just him.
Mm.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And this is where Daniel dies, apparently.
That's right.
Tragedy. And we get to see that the Stargate, I think, is this when we see the Stargate technology is also sort of like a mini transporter? I guess we get introduced to the kind of rings coming down.
That's right. And sort of... Such a great noise that they make when they're sort of like a magnetic thrum, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, no, great stuff. And I guess, and I like the, again, like you say, the design of this is great. And, you know, the fact that the sarcophagus is also kind of a rejuvenation chamber, a kind of medical bay kind of thing that heals Daniel. And that's one of the reasons why the alien chose humans, because they're so easy to repair and manipulate, I guess. And, you know, not only physically, but I guess mentally as well, by instating himself as this godlike figure.
Yeah.
But again, this is all great. What I love about these sort of things, it's all great setup. All the stuff we're seeing now, like, you know, you see Kurt Russell kind of look at the switch on the guy's hand when he presses it to summon the transporter. We get to see the transporter coming down, and we get to see the sarcophagus. It's all setting up the finale. all these little moments, which I kind of love. And this is our first introduction, proper introduction to Ra, Jay Davison as Ra, as he confronts our guys. Oh, well, yeah, because this is before Daniel gets shot, isn't it? They kind of get brought before Ra. And we get introduced to, and again, I am going to mispronounce his name like mad. Damon Hustle? I'm going to pronounce it badly, Scott. You've always got to save me.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Jimin Honsu.
That's it. Jimin Honsu. Yeah. And again, this was one of his first, if not his first on-screen role. And he's went on to an incredible career. But again, as one of the henchmen number three. He's not even lead henchman.
No, he's not. He's not. Yeah, that's it, isn't it? So he's not reached the heady heights that he's going to achieve.
I mean, he's down here as Horus. He's one of the Horuses. And Anubis is the main henchman.
Mm.
We get to see Ra, and he shoots Daniel out of nowhere because he's trying to protect Jack, I guess, who again is just going completely off script as usual. complete death wish. And I like the humor. I guess if I was an insane kind of alien, I would just surround myself with children as a human shield. That's a good tactic.
Yes, it is. Yeah. If you're a psycho who needs to keep power, absolutely.
And it gets chucked into a watery prison, very kind of with the remaining, again, I lose track of we're almost down to our final few soldiers.
You'd think.
We think there's a couple left.
Yeah.
Ferretti. Oh, we go Ferretti. I'm Freeman and Kowalski. That's it, Kowalski. You get his name shouted out. And while this was all happening, while they were going back, they are getting tracked by the tribesman's chief's son. Again, I forget his name, and his little posse to the pyramid as well.
Scarra and his friends. Scarra and friends. They're never given names.
Oh, I see. That sounds like a spin-off series as well. They should have done that. Scar and Friends. This basically sets up our next big kind of, I guess, our big set piece of the execution. Daniel gets kind of brought back from the dead, and Ra does a bit of exposition, kind of reveals his true intent, or at least, you know, he's a dying alien. He found this ancient civilization on Earth and decided to kind of instate himself as a god. Because we learned that there was a big revolution on Earth. This is from all the hieroglyphs, isn't it, underneath the city?
That's right.
And there was a rebellion, and then they sealed the Stargate, or at least did we seal the Stargate, or the aliens sealed the Stargate? Somebody did.
I think it was the humans. Yeah. So yeah, there was the uprising, and then the Egyptians buried the Stargate and put this big sort of tombstone on top of it, didn't they?
And now they're back, but they brought with them an atom bomb, as a nuclear warhead. Which Ra is now going to send back through the gate with his minerals, which will increase the explosive capabilities or power of the. So this is our stakes, Scott. I guess this is our ticking clock. Unless Ra wants to obviously keep his power on this planet, doesn't want to have the influence of these humans from Earth. So Daniel has to execute or kill his fellow travelers in order to prove that Ra is the one true god. And that's basically our setup for our big kind of execution scene. That's right, isn't it? That's where we're
at. That's right.
So I'm just trying to keep track. I'm looking at my notes. I guess because they're kind of, you know, they escape from the execution. Daniel kind of gets alerted to the fact that the crowd have the son, the tribesman's son, I keep forgetting his name, has got a gun.
Yeah.
Scarra's got a gun. And this is the start of the kind of proto revolution, I guess.
That's right, because the chieftain doesn't want to revolt, does he? He doesn't want this. He doesn't want a revolution. He's they've obviously learned, I guess through experience, that this is going to go poorly for them. However, it's the kids, it's Scarra and friends who are chomping at the bit for some freedom, and he's following the example. I guess we kind of missed that with Jack's story arc, isn't it? He's basically, Scarra becomes a little bit of a surrogate son to him during this movie.
Yeah.
You know, he kind of helps him out of his death wish mentality a little bit. So, you know, by turns, he kind of hero worships Jack a little bit as well. So he wants to fight. He wants to free his people and stuff. That's where Scarra and friends are at here now in this scene.
Yeah, because did they do the attack on the city before the execution scene? I'm trying to, because they send out a couple of those amazing, again, the design of this, like the cool ships to the city to kind of blow it up as a kind of punishment for helping out
yeah,
the strangers, or helping out the kind of the earthlings.
Yeah, that's right.
It does happen before that. Yeah. So, like I said, that's why our chief is very sort of, you know, we shouldn't have helped the strangers. We've suffered the wrath of Ra, and we need to get back to mining, back to worshipping, and it'll all be fine. But obviously, through Suri reading the hieroglyphs, or starting to read the hieroglyphs, and like I say, and the sun's relationship with hero worshipping Jack, we're starting to see the seeds of what happened on Earth on this planet, which I've completely forgotten the name of this planet.
Abydos.
And I guess this is kind of building towards the end, because they get rescued. Another one of the soldiers dies. Who knows which one? One of them. And they all run back to some sort of cave, and they've got all their guns. Jack's very angry that they've got the guns. Some of the soldiers think this is brilliant. This is our we've got a little army here. This is fantastic. But Jack's very much, you know, like you say, take the guns off them, because he knows the true danger of guns or of this. And this is where Daniel reveals, I guess, the plan within the plan, which is Jack's death wish and the atomic bomb.
That's right.
I keep wanting to call it not atomic bomb, but the warhead, the nuclear warhead. The nuke.
Which Ra has taken, and he kind of found it straight away, didn't he? And magnified its explosive potential by 200 times or something. So it's going to be a big deal, because he was going to send that back to Earth and blow Earth up.
Yeah, so this is our ticking clock, I guess. This is our thing we have to stop. And we can kind of convince Jack that this is the right thing to do. I'm trying to, because they're all in that weird kind of little stone encampment away from everybody, as they're kind of running away and they're kind of making their plan on what to do. And I guess this is where Daniel finds out that he's married.
Yeah.
He seems quite happy about that. It's all good. It's all fine. I'm trying to think, is there a turning point for Jack to kind of decide to do this? I'm trying to remember.
Say that again, mate.
Because I'm trying to remember, does Jack get, because he seems very unconvinced, I think, because Daniel sort of says to him, "What? Why are you so quick, you know, ready to die?" Yes. And I think Jack doesn't kind of admit that he is, you know, why he's kind of there, and his depression, really.
Yeah.
I mean, this seems to be, and I'm not sure who kind of turns Jack around a bit. I feel like there is something, I'm trying to remember if there's a scene or something in this bit that kind of changes Jack's mind.
That I remember. No. It's pretty much, they kind of just get swept up in the mini revolution, isn't it, with Skara and his friends. Doesn't Ra himself intercede at this point, because they're fighting, he's fighting Ra's sort of chief captain, isn't he, O'Neill?
Well, this is, I mean, because so this sort of sets up the, they have to go back, and they're gonna have, they've got to bring like a shipment of the mineral that's gonna go with the atomic, with the bomb, with the warhead, back through the Stargate to sort of blow up the other side on Earth. So they intercept the caravan, I guess, that's going to the pyramid, and they take the place of the people bringing the mineral with all the soldiers to infiltrate back in to try and grab back, I guess, the warhead before they send it through. Is their very rough plan. There's basically now there's like three soldiers and a lot of boys and Daniel. Oh no, four soldiers, I guess, if you count Jack.
That's pretty much it.
And their plan was to dress up as
locals. Yeah.
And then grab it. Again, who knows?
Did we mention that Daniel's discovered the symbol home at this point as well, hasn't he?
That's what I'm confusing with. I remember there was some big
Scar and his friends are celebrating while Jack's looking on disapprovingly, and Scar draws a sign of victory on the wall, which Daniel recognizes. He sort of looks up and goes, "There he is.
Yeah.
Found the seventh symbol. You haven't found it." Scar has drawn it.
Yeah, and again, once Scar has drawn it, you kind of think, well, okay, so the symbol for Earth was a pyramid with one sun, and the symbol for this planet is a pyramid with three suns. Not that complicated. No offense, Daniel. But anyway, no. But yes, he's found a seventh symbol. That's how great. Yeah, it always turns around and goes, "We're going home to random soldier number three. I'll get you home, even though most of you are dead now. I'm going to get the remnants of this. Don't worry, we're very excited. Whoever's left alive, I can get home." and again, this is now, we're now in finale territory. We're zipping along. Because they ambush the caravan, but before they ambush the caravan, because for some reason they shoot one of the henchmen by the minerals, and Daniel kind of takes off the guy's mask to reveal it's just a man.
That's right.
Look at your gods.
Yes.
As we all should do, Scott. It's just a man. And so that, like I say, they're sowing the seeds for what's going to happen. And now we're into our finale. So what is your view on, again, let's talk it a bit as a whole. Let's not break it down into its component parts, but the finale of this, because I feel like, you know, looking back on this now, like I say, we're looking back, this is the whole point of this season. I think it's got an incredibly strong start. The first half an hour is just such a great setup.
Yeah.
I think the middle bit is really good as well. We're getting into the characters. We're getting into this new planet. We're getting into some great aliens. I feel like it does fall down a bit in the finale. I don't know. I feel like rewatching it recently.
Yeah.
I don't know how you feel, Scott, but I think the beats are there. I think I love the fight between Jack and henchman number one. I think I like Daniel kind of trying to rescue Suri because she gets shot. I'm not sure about the soldiers doing whatever the hell they're doing outside.
They're so weird. It's such a weird, it's very unusual to just have soldiers in there as a plot device, really, isn't it? Just as throwaway. Well, is it very unusual? I don't know. But it is in terms of this movie. They're not the focus at all, are they?
No. And I think, the weirdest thing is never. Oh, go on. No, go, Scott.
What about the death of Scar's small ugly friend? That's the only way I can describe him. Bless him.
I know, because it's kind of how he's portrayed. It's a shame because that is how he's kind of
the comic portrayed relief.
Comic relief character. And yeah, you're right. And he's with the kind of meaningless. Well, he's with French Stewart and the other guy.
Yeah,
and they're kind of trapped outside the pyramid.
It's horrifying, isn't it? He's running along. They're going, come on, mate, to the barricade, and he's got one of the soldiers' helmets on his head and he's panning along, and then those sort of awesome fighter craft fly across and just obliterate him, and all you see is the helmet tumbling away. It's horrifying. Yeah, I completely forgotten about that till I watched it again.
No, and to be honest, like you say, you feel more of an
impression.
But yeah, because you feel more of an impression with him than you have of any of the soldiers who have died over the course of this film.
Yeah.
So you're right. But R.I.P. ugly friend.
And ugly funny friend.
And I think I sort of texted you this because you were in the finale, and I remember and watching it. Never put a ticking clock on a finale. I feel you're always going to trip up because Jack sets the atomic bomb. It's down there. It's by the Stargate, and he said, "I don't know what you know." He's going to set it off. And for some reason, it's set to 7 minutes. Seems like a very odd time. I don't know. I always feel like it should be a rounded number. Anyway, he sets it off and he's got 7 minutes to do everything. And I've written down, Scott, I made a list. Here's everything that happens in 7 minutes, okay?
Okay.
So in 7 minutes, Suri gets shot. Daniel then takes her up to the ship, puts her in the sarcophagus, heals her. We don't know how long that process takes.
No.
And it shuts incredibly slowly. We know that.
It's at least 3 minutes
gone. That's a good 3 minutes gone. Opening and shutting, that's your 7 minutes right there. There's the big fight between Jack and Buff Henchman. There's a start of an revolution outside.
Anubis, that guy is.
Yeah, Anubis.
Yeah.
Then his entire revolution starts outside. You know, they run down that hill with the tribes chief. Still 7 minutes, Scott. Still on. There is the death. The death also happens during the 7 minutes. So poor ugly boy dies. There's a beheading of henchman Anubis gets beheaded by great scene. Say hello to King Tut. Give my regards to King Tut. You got to have a lion, Scott.
You do got to have a lion, and that's a good one.
We're still going. So he heals her, goes back down. The spaceship incredibly slowly takes off, still in 7 minutes. We've still got 2 minutes left, apparently. And that's when they have the big idea of, oh, the spaceship's taken off. We can transport, because we've got the dead body, the atomic bomb up the ship. All in 7 minutes, Scott. Woo! That's a lot.
That's an action-packed 7 minutes, isn't it?
I don't mind, you know, this is, you know, you're in, but I don't know. It doesn't, I think all the stuff that happens inside the pyramid is really good. I think all the stuff outside is a bit superfluous, but it's basically for the revolution. It's for the cool scene of them all sweeping down the desert dunes to,
that's right. The chieftain's come around.
He has.
He's come to save his son.
But did you have any problem with the 7 minutes, or did
no
you not
do you know
it?
What no I didn't even pick up on it. I was at this point in the movie, I guess I'm just being swept along by the pace of it and everything that's going on, and it didn't even cross my mind that, hang on a minute, that's only 7 minutes, how the hell has all this happened? You're absolutely right. I'll never look at the end of this movie the same way again.
No, I don't, and I don't mean to. It's not to ruin it. And there's a great...
No, that's it now. No, I'm never going
to... And just to kind of call out the great fight between Kurt Russell and Buff Henchman, hence Anubis.
Anubis.
There's a great... I don't know if you remember this moment. There's a great moment in the middle of the fight where they're kind of wrestling over the cool weapon, staff, stick. And Anubis kind of realizes, and so does Kurt Russell, and you don't really get this in, because usually, you know, with action heroes nowadays, they've always got to be the strongest.
That's
but there's
right.
a moment where he goes, oh, I'm stronger than you.
I am much stronger than you. And Kurt Russell looks at his sort of biceps and stuff like that and goes, oh, man.
Oh, shit. It's such a great little moment. I love it.
That's very Kurt Russell, though, isn't it? Mm. You know, he's when he has played the action hero, I guess kind of a bit like Indiana Jones, Harrison Ford and Indiana Jones. Mm. He's a fallible action hero, you know.
Definitely. Yeah. And I love the moment where, because he gets beheaded by a great scene, great kind of moment. And poor Suri wakes up. They look over at her and there's basically a beheaded body. She must have basically woken up in like a pool of blood. And she kind of does this great look down like, oh, I was dead a minute ago. And now I wake up to basically a decapitated
corpse.
What a lovely, lovely way. Can we get more 90s than a shockwave explosion, Scott?
No, we can't. Classic shockwave explosion.
You've got to do it. You've got to have it. I mean, this is, you know, George Lucas put him into Star Wars.
That's right.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, you've got to have the shockwave.
So how did you feel about Stargate now? How do you feel about it? Do you still love it? Do you still rate it?
I do. I think I do. I think for the setup is amazing. The idea is, you know, such a great, you know, we all love the kind of, I, you know, aliens are responsible for ancient civilization stuff. I love that stuff. You know, even if you don't believe it or not, it's still a great kind of story. So I love all that stuff. The design of it, the James Spader kind of really giving it his all, even though, you know, you say, I think it was questioned, the script and stuff. I think casting is really good. It's a couple of niggles, I say, the weird casting of French Stewart. And
it's so odd.
still to this day, every time he turns up,
he speaks, it's just
he's got his arms out when they're putting the and it's like, he's weedy, he wouldn't survive as a airman, soldier, whatever. But yeah, other than that, I really love this film. I think it holds up. I think it's a great kind of sci-fi adventure that we don't get enough of nowadays. How about you, Scott? How does it hold up for you?
Yeah, I agree with you. I really enjoyed watching this movie again. And this is a sci-fi, unusually, this is a sci-fi movie that Vicky really likes too. Mm. I guess it hit us both at the right age. She loved watching it again with me. So, you know, it's I have very fond memories of watching this with you. So there is some nostalgia attached to it.
Completely.
But I do think it's a movie that I think my kids would watch it too, because it does sweep you along. There's a lot of action in it, though there is some plot, and it's presented to you in a very sort of logical. I mean, like you said, the setup to it is just. It blew me away. I thought, wow, this is like the best start. This is one of the most solid starts to a movie I've seen recently. It really just lays it all out there in front of the audience, you know, and then you can just enjoy the rest of the movie. Some of the CGI, obviously, from a movie from 1994 is a little bit, you know, it's lost its edge a little bit, but I didn't watch it thinking, my God, this looks dated. By any terms, and I still really, really think they perfectly nailed that sci-fi fusion of Egyptian and alien, absolutely perfect. If anything, I wanted to see more of it. We got more of it in Stargate, didn't we? In the TV series, not quite the same as a big budget movie, but you know, it didn't have a small budget, the television series, so. Does it make me want to see more Stargate? Does it make you want to see more Stargate?
I don't know. Again, I think...
Rebooted Stargate?
I feel like, again, the film is good enough to stand up now. I think I would worry a bit about how they would handle it now. And I just feel like, even though we had years of the TV show afterwards, I feel like it's a perfect little, you know, not little, but quite a perfect story, told really well, done. I don't feel like I'm tantalized to want to know more, but I don't know if I need to know more. And I don't quite know what a reboot would bring to it. Or, you know, are they just going to do a solid sort of straight up and down, we'll just modernize it? Or is it going to be something? I mean, the thing you said, like, in, you know, exploring, because there are rumors about, you know, like, other civilizations and alien connections. I'd much rather them kind of go that route and look at other civilizations they could sci-fi up, because and then connect it in that way, rather than going down this kind of route again. You know, if they're going to make another one, use Stargate as a, you know, do it as a sequel rather than a reboot.
But
how about you, Scott? Do you want to know more?
I think it probably would pique my interest enough to go and see it, you know. Like you, I think this movie exists as it's a perfect thing in terms of it being a story and then being done. You don't need to know any more than you've seen, but the potential existed, because like God knows how many series of Stargate SG-1 there was, but it was super popular. I could do more Stargate, like I say. And I still like this movie as much as I did first time I saw it, so warts and all. So,
yeah, no, it's definitely, you know, it gives the badge. If we are giving badges out in this season, it earns the badge. It is as good as we remember.
It is, yeah.
So it is. So it wins, or it's,
it wins. You won.
Well done. You won Stargate.
Well done. You won Stargate. Congratulations.
And I think we again, the problem with this season is that there's too many, and Scott and I keep thinking of new
what
ones.
About this?
I just thought of this. Oh, this just popped up in my feed.
We've got a super good one coming up next, though.
We have, and I don't want to tease it. I don't want to reveal too much, but we're very excited about the next one.
Yeah.
And it definitely fits very neatly into this category.
Yeah.
But thumbs up to Stargate. So we had two good ones in a row. That's cool.
Yeah.
And next time we'll be back with more. But until then, Scott, thank you for stepping through the Stargate with me.
Thank you for taking me through the Stargate, Paul.
Until next time, I'll speak to you later, man.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to It's a Chat with me, Paul Williams, and Scott Charnock. If you want to ask us a question, we can be reached on Twitter at It's a Chat Podcast, or you can email us at itsachatpod@gmail.com. Our theme music is by Aaron Kenny, and always remember, it's a chat!